Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. Professor Katie Watson is a classic polymath, a case of how many hats can one person wear well. She's a lawyer, having clerked in the federal judiciary and practiced public interest law. She's an ethicist who's completed fellowships in clinical medical ethics and medical humanities. And she's also an adjunct faculty member at Chicago's Second City Theater's Training Center.
And that does not count her day job as a professor of law, ethics, and humanities at Northwestern. And because she needs to keep her sense of humor, she practices what she teaches, regularly performing stand-up improv comedy.
She found time in that very busy schedule to present at the most recent medical humanities lecture at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and she stopped by the Lake Effect studio while she was here. She explained why you shouldn't be fearful that your doctor is improvising.
So medical improv is the adaptation of theatrical improvisation skills and insights, and using what's so essential about that and what overlaps with medicine to help train clinicians be better clinicians. So while patients might not like the idea of improv in medicine, the first thing I'd say is that shows a lack of understanding of how much of medicine is spontaneous. It doesn't mean it's unprepared. It means it's formatted to be just for you. And that's what you want, right? When we talk about individualized medicine, it's not from a cookbook. It's not a cookie cutter. And so physicians need to be trained, and nurses and all other clinicians, to not just respond to what they think is going to happen, but to respond to what is actually happening and what is unique about you. And those are the kind of skills that improv can teach.
When you talk about improv from a theatrical perspective, you're talking about two or more actors getting together and not having a script.
Yes.
And so you're talking, in the case of medicine then, about deviating from the expected script of, like, I come to you, Dr. So-and-so, and I'm presenting with, like, a heart palpitations or shortness of breath or something. There might be something else going on. I mean, the first thing you might think of, oh, she's having a heart attack. But it might not be that. And so is what you're talking about with the improv of training clinicians to say, wait a minute, let's step back just a minute here and see what's actually happening?
Yes, there's two essential pieces to it. So the one is when you say that actors come to improv and just make everything up. Of course, that's exactly what we do. But we're not blank slates. We're not newborn babies. We bring to stage every bit of information we've gathered over our lives, every bit of experience, every person we've ever met, and we pick and choose what to bring to stage based on the moment, not pre-planned, but not unprepared, if that makes sense.
Yes.
And so your physician comes to you with that same knowledge bank of medicine, but also that same knowledge bank of people and moments and situations, right? And of the complexities of the hospital and healthcare generally. And what you want is for them to be able to spontaneously reformat all that information as appropriate, right? So that's one aspect, to take everything they already brought about your heart palpitations and your shortness of breath and your age and gender and fill in whatever else and bring that all appropriately. So that's one thing. The second thing is the preparation for the unexpected. Because, you know, you and I didn't know what we were going to say to one another, but we have cultural scripts that say, you're the interviewer, we're having a conversation in a radio station, there are certain things we would think would be shocking or inappropriate in this moment, right? We still have expectations, even though we don't have scripts. So to be able to learn when to let go of your expectation, to learn to look for those surprises. So in improv, theatrically, we say follow the unexpected, follow the unusual. When there's something that's just different in what was said or done, usually that's the interesting place to go. And often that's true in medicine also. So say you present with all those symptoms. There is a likely diagnosis. You know, you go down your differential and you could say, what, I'm ruling things out. But when you do what we call deep listening, meaning I'm not just listening to the content of your words, I'm listening to how you said it, I'm listening to your body language, I'm listening to your facial expressions, I'm listening to your silence, I'm listening to how what you quote-unquote say as I am speaking as well, I might get more information that says, I'm thinking about domestic violence right now. I'm thinking about all the other reasons a woman might come to the emergency room in the middle of the night rather than stay in bed and wait till morning. I'm thinking about a whole host of other things. Who brought you here? Why did you come in a taxi? You know, a whole host of other things. It doesn't mean I'm going to ignore your primary complaint, but means that I see you as a whole person. I see your social context, or at least I have curiosity to inquire about what I don't see and understand that's a closed door, not a blank space.
One of the things that comes to mind as we're talking about this is that doctors and other medical professionals are so time crunched.
Mm-hmm.
How do you train them with this work to trust their guts? That's kind of what you're asking them to do in 15 seconds.
Well, in 15 seconds, your gut is the best tool you have. Right? Because gathering an encyclopedic amount of information will not be possible. And so this is not fly by the seat of your pants, cut corners sort of training. The idea is the difference between efficient communication and rushed communication. Rushed communication says, I have to go through the whole encyclopedia and we have 15 seconds. I guess I'm just going to yammer at you. Efficient communication says, I am going to use all my training, all my experience, and all my instincts to hone in on that one thing. You said that thing that didn't make sense. I'm going to go to the thing that didn't make sense to me rather than everything that does make sense. I am comfortable with ambiguity and complexity, and I know sometimes if I go there first, I get to what turns out to be our destination, whether it's predictable or surprising, faster.
That comfort with ambiguity is something that humans really aren't.
Not our jam.
No, we don't like it. And so I know from your training with Second City and doing the kind of theatrical improv that you do, you get more comfortable with it. How are you working with doctors and other medical professionals to get them more comfortable with not knowing? Doctors are supposed to know everything.
I know. So we put them between this rock and a hard place where we say, you have to know everything. You have to have it memorized. You have to be perfect all the time. And then if they make a mistake or want to take more time or tell us, well, I'm not sure, you know, we freak out. But at the same time, when they don't do those things, there's a rush to judgment, right? They're like, I know what it is. I'll ignore those three symptoms that don't fit the diagnosis and move on. And so I think we all need to understand we're all human beings operating in complex spaces, doing our best. And for clinicians, and I work largely with medical students, but I work with experienced clinicians as well. And the experienced clinicians know this. It's just harder to want to own and embrace to say, well, you've got to do both. You've got to be in our spaces where we do memorization and we do have answers and you have to master those. And then you simultaneously have to have the other foot in this unknown and ambiguous place. So improv, think of it like, I wouldn't want to use the word therapy, but like immersion therapy, where you say, if you're afraid of heights, maybe let's spend some time on a bridge with very good railings to just, you know, get used to this. Improv, you are put in spaces of not knowing and ambiguity and chaos, and you are asked to stay there and work through it, but in a very low stakes environment. So with my students and my clinicians, we're not performing for audiences. The stakes couldn't be lower. It doesn't matter whether you, quote, succeed or fail. It doesn't matter. And yet we're people, so we want to do well, right? And my point to them is, if you can succeed in this space where you really didn't know anything, what if you were totally prepared and had trained all your life for this? And then you use these skills. Think how successful you will be. So it is partly about naming it and saying, we don't like this. Identify in yourself your own habits of premature closure or forcing people into types because you need them to fit in their boxes. Or if you've become rigid in your roles in a way that's not productive for patient care, can you identify that first, where your Achilles heel is? And then second, can you work on it in a safe space? So I think of medical improv as cross-training. You know, why does the marathoner do sit-ups? That doesn't look like running. Well, those muscles are going to help when you are running. We don't do medical scenarios. We talk about the links, but it's not like we're acting out doctor-patient encounters. We're really doing modified theatrical improv, the idea being to train you that when you are in this other medical space, that you've got those muscles you built in this cross-training to add to all your content knowledge in those ambiguous, chaotic situations.
You said you're not using medical scenarios in this. There are a lot of actors who are pretending to be patients.
Simulating patients.
Mm-hmm. So that's another form of that, where you're helping people, although they're dealing with a particular medical situation that they're supposed to figure out. But I would think that the improv would help them think outside the box.
Absolutely. And I think in those standardized patient encounters are so valuable because, again, you lower the stakes. You're not actually ill. The challenge with them is, particularly for my learners, is they have to bring all their skills. So they're new to the medical world. So they're like in their, they have this Rolodex in their head that you could almost see flipping in their, behind their eyes as they're like, diabetes, what are the 10 things that I have to ask? You know, their eyes roll up to the ceiling as they like try to look for the answer. And they're supposed to act like a warm human being and have a conversation with you. And it's really hard. And part of the reason I started creating this work was I observed my wonderful, lovely, warm, gracious, eloquent medical students who you in the hallway, you'd be like, that young man or woman is just terrific. They would put on a short white coat and go to these standardized patient encounters and turn into robots. And it would be like, where is that young woman I just talked to in the hallway? She left, stayed in the hallway. And then doctor came in and there was a role that they were assuming that they were uncomfortable in. And also just the weight of their new knowledge had then boxed out all the human skills they had that they brought to the door of that room and left behind. And for me, medical improv was about to not say, oh, now you have to become a doctor, you know, fill in social role here and figure out what is that, or occupy a role that perhaps you carried around in your head. The point is, how can you be your best, most professional and true version of yourself? How can you be the best version of yourself who also has a ton of medical knowledge, who someone has now come to trust and be vulnerable with? What do you already bring to bear, and how can you heighten that and enhance that?
How did you get interested in all of this? You're a lawyer by training. Mm-hmm. You're also an improv person, and you teach at Second City as well. Mm-hmm. How did all of it come to bear for you?
Yeah, it was serendipitous, as many of these things are, right? There was no 5-year plan that could include this. I was a lawyer, still am, and I took my first improv class thinking this would be good for my litigation skills. I had just moved to Chicago, saw improv for the first time, thought it was amazing, took a class, fell in love. So I thought that I had separate lives. I had a professional life, and then I had this theater work that I was taking more and more of my time, and I was falling in love with writing and sketch writing and playwriting and doing all sorts of things. And I was very busy with that. Around the same time, I did a fellowship in clinical medical ethics, and I became a bioethicist, and I joined the faculty at Northwestern. But I still thought this was very separate during my fellowship year. In my fellowship year, we have a program where we teach medical humanities seminars to students where they take a 10-hour seminar in their first and second year. And as a fellow, I got to create a seminar. And I did a different topic for my first seminar. Then I had the experience on Saturday nights, I was doing improv shows, and my boss started showing up. And for a lot of people, that's their nightmare. Like, I'm on stage without a script. For me, it was, I'm on stage without a script. That's normal Saturday night. But my boss is in the audience. And so that was my nightmare. It turned out she was a theater fan, and it turned out she was interested in how doctors think. And when she was asking me, how in the world do you all do that? Of course you have something pre-prepared, right? And I was explaining, no, it's 45 minutes. It's long form. It's like a play. Characters come back. I just have to remember great detail. I have to, you know, I was explaining, because a lot of this is an oral tradition. There's more written now, but, you know, 10, 15 years ago, less so. It just was so similar to what physicians need to do with someone they don't know walking in the room, trying to figure out what is it we're going to do here today, build a story together, all those things. And so when I saw that phenomena in the medical students of how they became different people, in conversation with her, it became clear, I think that I know all, there's something I know from this other work that I saw as completely unrelated, that absolutely we could put this chocolate and this peanut butter and make something different and new that would be useful. So medical improv, I'm not teaching them to be funny. You know, people say like, oh, well, patients don't want to hear stand-up comedy. And I say, well, great, because that's not what we do. You know, we're not here to perform. We're here to take the piece of improvisational theater that develops these essential skills and then translate that into the medical world. And that's what one branch of medical humanities does. You know, you might think about writing a narrative and teach that to doctors as a way for them to be attentive to storytelling and think about, when I write down patient reports, patient denies, I'm the narrator of a story in which I depict another character's actions. How have I done that? Who else gets to tell this story? Who speaks? So thinking about narrative analysis, that's a humanities approach to enhance medical skills. And medical improv is like that, too. So that's one branch, the sort of applied arts branch of the medical humanities. So for me, it was just being in the right place at the right time, being at a supportive institution that embraced medical humanities, and then having this arts life that I perceived as being completely unrelated, and having the opportunity to say, hey, I'm one person and I move to different spaces, but I can bring everything, each piece to the other side and integrate them as it is useful to others.
Now, you're doing this with medical students and, as you say, sometimes clinicians who are already practicing.
Yes.
Are you working with other medical professionals, nurses and PAs and even, you know, the person who comes to take your blood, the phlebotomist?
Yeah, on occasion. So there have been different opportunities. Often it's physicians, but there's one program at Indiana University in Indianapolis that is specifically training for teams. And so people have to come. It's a physician, a nurse, and either like a chaplain or a social worker who already work together as a team so they can build their teamwork skills in other ways. And then I've done trainings that have had multiple clinicians attend. For me, the way I can spread this work best is I do a train the trainer program. I've done it for 4 years. I had to skip last year. I'm doing it again this summer. And in that training, I get clinicians from all different fields. I've had pharmacists, dentists, nurses, physicians, social workers, you name it, come. And then they both take my course, and then I do a how to teach my course, completely second trained, and they do practice training on my wonderful medical student volunteers. And then they can go out and take my work and implement it where they are. So it's part of the curriculum at the UCLA School of Dentistry. There's an Arizona School of Physical Therapy that uses it. So the curriculum has been dispersed through these approximately 100 people throughout the country in other fields as well.
Is that something you're hoping to do here with the Medical College of Wisconsin?
It won't be today. I'm doing a lecture.
Right.
But who knows what the future holds? Because the idea is to, if I can train people to do it, then they can train a lot more people than I can. You know, I am a bioethicist and do other work as well. I wish I could do this full time, but I can't. But that's the way for me to train the trainer, because the first time I published on it, I had physicians calling me saying, this sounds great. Can you send me your syllabus? And I said, first of all, it's not really that great of a syllabus. Second of all, it wouldn't make any sense. Third, have you ever taught improv? No. Have you ever done improv? No. Have you ever seen improv? No, but I could figure it out. Well, that's a terrific spirit, and I'm glad they thought it seemed useful, but it won't be successful. You know, and so I figured I've got to put my time where my mouth is. If they wanted, I need to train people to take those good intentions forward. And I've developed a big written thing and blah, blah, blah.
It's funny. I have a theatrical background. Uh-huh. That was my major in undergraduate. And people often say, well, you know, what use is a theater degree going to do unless you're working in theater?
Sure.
And I said, you know, theater fits into everything in life because
mm-hmm.
it is an exploration of mm-hmm. everything mm-hmm. In human experience. And the way you've managed to put it together for this is just wonderful.
Oh, thank you. I agree with you. I think I don't have a theater degree. I envy you. I knew I would be going to law school to be a civil liberties lawyer. So, and I don't regret that one bit.
No, that's good too.
That's good too. Yep. I maintain that is important. And I treasure my work in bioethics and I work in reproductive justice. So that's my content area in bioethics right now. But I think a theater degree is a psychology degree. It is a literature degree. And it is a PE degree all wrapped up in one, right?
And performance and
yep.
art appreciation.
Yes.
It's
so interdisciplinary that we don't think of it as such usually.
Right.
You know? And
right.
fashion, if you got to do the costume course.
Exactly. Fashion and how
history.
Light works. History. Yeah, there's so much mm-hmm. that it pulls in
mm-hmm.
That it's a perfect platform to do this kind of work, too.
Well, and I think theater and medicine, and Bonnie, this is exciting in our conversation to come up on new things because, you know, you think you've thought about something a lot, and then every time you chat about it, something new comes up. What you're pointing up to me is theater is all about that slice of life. When you write a play, it's why are we here now? Why these people and why at this moment? And theater is usually about heightened experiences, the moment when the night it was different, the person who, or it's a slice of life that says something really important about who we are, and quotes around we, whoever the we is. But it's distilled. We only have an hour or two together. It's not the drip trip of we're going to watch this character put on her socks and make her sandwich, right? Medicine's like that too. People come for that moment, that slice. Tonight is the night in the emergency room. Everything is different. This is the season we're going to treat that cancer. This is the season we're going to say goodbye to mom. You know, it may not be 2 hours long, but it is often peak moments or essential blocks of time, life-altering forks in the road in medicine. And I think theater and a training in theater and appreciation of theater captures that essential heightened human thing. What is both so specific to the character and yet universal to us all is the best theater often. And in medicine, capturing, you know, what is specific to Bonnie and what is it about that brought her tonight that is universal to human suffering and human healing.
To all of us. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And finding the universal in the specific.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Katie Watson, we could keep talking.
We could, and we might.
Let's turn off the microphone.
Yes.
But have a wonderful time here in Milwaukee.
It's such a treat to be here. The Medical College of Wisconsin is fantastic. And the fact that they've done so much work embracing the medical humanities really sets them apart nationally.
And it's wonderful to have you as a representative of that here in the studio. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Dr. Katie Watson is a professor of law, ethics, and humanities at Northwestern University and an adjunct associate professor of medical education and obstetrics and gynecology at Northwestern's Feinberg School of Medicine.
She's also an adjunct on the teaching faculty at Chicago's Second City. She was in Milwaukee in the fall to give the Medical College of Wisconsin's annual medical humanities lecture. And you can find links about everything that she does at WUWM.com.